Please be advised that this podcast contains descriptions of graphic violence. I'm not joking. I'm not kidding around. Serious descriptions of seriously graphic violence. So if you don't like that, and if you have children around, or anybody who shouldn't hear that, please turn off now. Final warning. If anyone ever invited you to Belanglo State Forest, I mean, there's no way in the world I'd ever go there. It sounds like hell, doesn't it?
Oh, Michelle, I've taken so many people there.
Have you?
Maybe I need to take you there. Yes, it's. I think it's interesting to go there. I go to a lot of crime scenes. I need to see the journey of the victims. And so going there, you realise how desolate it is because you not only turn off the main freeway, but it's 7Ks then into the forest. And it's hard, up and down, dirt, rocks. It's quite terrifying. And if this was happening in the evening or at night, it is literally pitch black. I've been out there at midnight because this is what I do.
Yeah.
And there's not a sound. It's full stars. You know, light pollution isn't there because it's just so desolate. And these victims are taken what looks like heaven, but it's actually hell.
Serial killer expert Amanda Howard is back on Australian True Crime to run us through a theory that may sound bonkers at first, but I promise you I've cross-referenced it with the people who should disagree with her the most, and they just don't. They all agree that the case against Australia's most infamous serial killer, Ivan Milat, is pretty shaky. The only difference is that Amanda is pen pals with Ivan and still talks to him about his case on a regular basis.
This is Australian True Crime with Michelle Laurie and Emily Webb. Come with us as we go beyond the news cycle to find out how people become killers, how people become victims, and what happens next.
Amanda is now the co-host of her own podcast. It's called Monsters Who Murder, and there's a link in the notes to this podcast. She hosts it with Robert McKnight, and it's a bit controversial because although no one can argue with Amanda's knowledge on the subject, which is encyclopedic, people do tend to get a bit creeped out by her close relationships with serial killers. You see, she's usually writing to over 100 of them at any one time, and quite often she's talking regularly to a few of them over the phone too. She says it's all in the name of research, and I think her podcast is pretty great. That's where I first heard this idea that the case against Ivan isn't quite as watertight as I always assumed it was. Before we go on, though, because we'll be talking so much about Ivan in this episode, I think we should start by remembering his 7 known victims and their families. Joanne Walters, 22, and Carolyn Clark, 21, were both from England, but met in Sydney, where they became friends and decided to travel on together. They left their hostel in April 1992, telling their families they were heading to Mildura to make some money picking fruit. Joanne was particularly reliable when it came to keeping in touch with her parents. So when they hadn't heard from her in a month, they flew to Australia to try and find her. Just 4 months later, her remains were found in Belanglo State Forest, off the Hume Highway in New South Wales, by cross-country runners. Carolyn's were found by police the following day. Dr. Peter Bradhurst, the forensic pathologist who carried out the autopsies, reported that Joanne had died in a frenzied stabbing attack, having sustained up to 20 wounds in the back and 10 in the chest. Some of the back wounds appeared to be deliberately intended to sever the spine, rendering her paralysed. She had no defensive wounds to the hands and upper arms, which was unusual in such an attack. Carolyn had been blindfolded with her arms raised above her head. She'd been shot 10 times in the head and stabbed once. Dr. Bradhurst proposed a theory that Carolyn may have been used for target practice. He also reported that he felt two killers had been involved in the crime, given that two different methods had been used. And he's not the only person who's put that theory forward, not by a long shot. Before returning to England, Joanne's distraught parents fronted the Australian media in a plea for information about the killer. A full year later, but only 600 metres away, the skeletal remains of Melbourne couple Deborah Everest and James Gibson were found by local man Bruce Pryor, who'd taken it upon himself to search the area for more victims in his spare time. They'd departed Melbourne 4 years earlier, planning a low-key, long weekend away for Confest, the music festival. Deborah's mother, Pat, had strongly encouraged her to go. The two of them had been nursing Deborah's father through his terminal illness, and Pat felt Deborah deserved a carefree weekend away with her boyfriend. "Go on," she told Deb. "The break will do you good." "Well, all right," Deb had replied, "but I'll be back in 3 days to clean your outside windows." But Deb didn't return in 3 days. And when she hadn't returned in 4, both she and James were reported missing. Deborah's father died not long after she disappeared, leaving Pat to wait alone for news. It was a story she told a reporter 16 years later at an afternoon tea for the parents of victims at Bowral Police Station. Autopsies revealed that James had suffered the same paralysing stab wounds to his spine as Joanne Walters. Less than a month after Deborah and James were found in November of 1993, police scouring the dense scrub of Belangolo found a skull and some women's clothing. 2 years earlier, Erwin Schmidl had flown into Melbourne Airport expecting to be met by her adventurous daughter Simone. Simone, who'd been travelling solo around Australia, never made it. Having told her Sydney friends she'd hitchhiked down to meet her mother, she disappeared somewhere on the Hume Highway around the 20th of January 1991. Erwin reported Simone missing within 2 days of her arrival and stayed in Australia for 6 weeks before returning heartbroken to Germany. She learned the terrible news of the identification of Simone's remains on her radio. The police had not been able to contact her before the media got hold of the story. The clothes found with Simone, however, were not hers. They were identified as belonging to another missing German backpacker, Anja Habschied, who was not believed to have known Simone. Anja had been travelling with her boyfriend, Gabor Neugebauer, and neither had been heard of since Christmas 1991. Gabor had phoned his parents, complaining of the heat in Sydney, which made it hard for him to sleep, and Anja had written to her parents, telling them of their plans to travel to Darwin and then on to Asia through Indonesia. The couple was observed leaving their hostel in King's Cross on Boxing Day 1991, and there is also a baffling sighting of them in a caravan park in Darwin soon after, and a report of them missing their flight to Indonesia. The next thing we know for sure is that their families reported them missing and flew to Australia to conduct a search of their own. Gabor's parents and Anya's brother travelled the length and breadth of the Northern Territory, Queensland and New South Wales before returning home exhausted and no doubt more confused than before. 2 days after Simone's remains were found, Anya and Gabor's were located close by. Gabor had suffered the telltale injuries to his spine and gunshot wounds to his head. Anya had been decapitated, seemingly with one blow. An unused plane ticket was found at the site. So again, we see the prevalence of two very different methods of murder. And experts in this field agree that this is very, very rare in a single killer. Even the judge who convicted Ivan Milat of the crimes, Justice David Hunt, said during sentencing, "In my view, it is inevitable the prisoner was not alone in that criminal enterprise." So given the ferocity of the crimes we're talking about, the idea that we as a community have been so willing to stop thinking critically about this case, is, to say the very least, pretty frustrating, isn't it, Amanda?
It's extremely frustrating because regardless of Ivan's own guilt, there is very likely that there is another killer out there somewhere, but they don't want us to think about that.
Yeah. And it's sort of, we've sort of forgotten about it, I think. I think in the excitement of the, you know, the sensational case and then it's seeming to reach its conclusion, we've all just gone, oh, great, okay, well, that's done. We had a big serial killer. They caught him. He's crazy and he's in jail and he's self-harming and swallowing things and God knows what else. And that's the end of the story and we sort of don't want to know anymore. Well, how long after Ivan's arrest did you start talking to him?
It was about 1995. So where I'm actually currently sitting in my own house, I can see his house.
Wow, that's really?
Yeah, that's how close we live. So it's, I think that's part of the fascination I have in that he was a local. I probably, you know, knocked into him at the shopping centre that's kind of between our homes.
God, that's amazing. Yeah, I was going to say that. You mean the house that he was living in, not his house now, which is, which prison is he in now?
He's still in Supermax, so he's not going far. As far as I'm aware, though, you never know because I've been talking to another serial killer who was in Supermax and then he went into Gen Pop in Goulburn and now he's been moved to a totally different prison. So It's not out of the realms of possibility.
Okay. So he's the home that he was living in that was eventually raided by police where they found, famously found trophies, in inverted commas, from some of the victims is the house that you can see now.
Yes, that's right, in Eagle Vale, yeah.
Wow, okay. So 95, so that's what, roughly 5 years after his arrest?
No, he was arrested in, I think it's May 1994.
Oh, wow, okay.
Yeah, so it was very soon after. So, and I've spoken to him on and off over the years. There's been a couple of times I've taken breaks from writing to serial killers. It does get to you.
Mm-hmm.
So I did break a couple of times, but it's still going now. So, and my conversations I have with him is a lot to do with the evidence because it doesn't make sense. There's a missing link that I'm trying to put together.
Yeah, well,
and it's not there.
There's a few missing links. I heard on your podcast about this case. The first one that you raised was you don't seem to be able to find the moment or the link or the way that police decided to arrest Ivan.
Yeah, I mean, we often have cases where they find the DNA, they find something at the scene, someone saw them, but we have no witness evidence, we have no DNA evidence, and we have no crime scene evidence that says Ivan Milat was the killer. Now, a lot of people go, well, hang on a sec, how about Paul Onions?
Now, Paul Onions was the British backpacker who phoned in to one of the police lines, but his initial testimony was lost in the big stack of tips that came in. But he was he said that he was picked up by a man. He gave a description that later was judged to be an exact description of Ivan with the mustache. We'll get to the mustache shortly.
This is how Paul Onions described his experience to Australian 60 Minutes in 1996.
As Milat drove toward his killing ground, Paul began to sense him getting edgy.
He became a bit anti-racial to the, you know, the immigrants who were living in Australia. He found them, you know, quite offensive, really.
You go out west and you don't know if you're in Vietnam or bloody China.
I was so happy to get the ride. And then for all of a sudden, I thought, oh, no. First go, I've got the nutter. That was really your reaction.
I don't care where you come from. It's just not bloody right.
An hour and a half south of Sydney are the Southern Highlands, nice, tidy townships and grand weekenders. And just a few minutes off the highway, up a dirt road, is the Belanglo State Forest. As I approached the turnoff to this road, Paul Onions really began to get the jitters.
And then for some reason, we just started to slow down a bit and he just kept looking in his mirror. And if you can drive yourself, you find it a bit odd. And then I said, what's the problem, man? And he says, oh.
No, we'll lose the radio signal, mate, when we get this car out of Sydney. I'm going to pull over up the road and I'm going to get some cassettes from underneath the seat so we can listen to some music, eh?
That was his excuse, really, to get some cassettes from under the seat to put some music on. Well, it just seemed odd because there was actually cassettes in between us. Once the vehicle was pulled over and he got out to search under the seat, I thought, you know, there's two sides to your brain. There's the calm side saying, oh, you should be happy this guy's giving you a lift. What are you worried about? Then there's the other side saying, hold on, there's something doesn't feel right there. So the initial reaction to me then was, well, I'll just stretch my legs and see how it provokes him.
Why are you getting out of the car?
After all, it's a sunny day and there are quite a few cars
around.
That's
it. I had a little look around. I thought, well, what's the problem? Surely not here, like, not in this situation. So I thought, I'll just get back in and see what happens. So I got back in the vehicle and just put my seatbelt on. He watched me do his. He got back in. So I thought, oh, no problem. No problem at all. Then the next minute, he jumps straight back out and says, I'll just have a look under the seat one more time. And I thought, this is it.
I'll have one of those cassettes, huh?
So he just bent over, looked under the seat, and just pulled out a revolver. And obviously, all the questions was answered in one movement.
You know what this is? Easy, bro. What's wrong, mate? Look, please, just calm down, mate.
And then the next minute, he just pulled this rope from under the seat. And when I seen the rope, that just scared me more than the gun. But as soon as I seen the rope, I thought, oh, that's going to be a... You know, it's going to take a bit of time. He's going to do whatever he wants.
It's a robbery, that's what it is.
I just thought, I'm out of here, like. I was just, you know, obviously panicking and just running off away from the vehicle. I heard him shout, stop else I'll shoot, stop else I'll shoot. And then I just heard the gun go off. And that was like, it was like a massive jolt to your system, like you knew it was surreal then, like, you know, oh God, really panicking then. I was just really panicking then to try and stop some vehicles. And they obviously could see what was happening. And I was just stopping, slowing down, and just driving straight off. I thought, oh, nobody's going to stop. It's just like a passing of time. I was just about to give up and say, oh, yeah, he's won. I better go back.
The car.
And I thought, if I go back there, that, you know, it just seemed that was the end if I go back there. And that's sort of when I made my mind up what I was going to do. I thought the next vehicle that comes over the bear of the hill, I'm just going to stop it no matter what.
But jump in front of it?
Yeah, it just seemed I'd rather stop a car, get killed, then go back to that vehicle and face the end that way.
If I hadn't stopped, yeah, he would have joined the others in the forest.
Or you'd have run him over.
Yeah, yeah.
It was Mrs. Joanne Berry who rescued Paul.
Panic. He was shaking, absolute petrified. I think he just about screamed, help me, he's got a gun. And that was very clear.
Joanne turned around and drove back to the nearest police station.
Which was?
Barrel Police Station. And I went in with Paul. We spoke to a young female constable in there. And
in their panic, no one got the number plate, but Paul told his story to the local policewoman on duty. Trouble is, that's where the information stayed, buried in the bowels of the police station. Remember that back in 1990, the location of the attack had no significance. It would be 2 years before the first bodies were found there.
And Ivan actually goes into a great lot of detail saying that apparently his first witness statement was nothing like what he looks like. And it's just that sort of police sort of put this photo under his nose and said, it's him, it's him, it's him. So, I mean, conspiracy theories maybe, but according to Ivan, the two witness descriptions were very, very different, and of course he says that it wasn't him anyway.
And of course the mustache, Paul Onions talks about the Merv Hughes style mustache. Merv Hughes being a massive cricketer, certainly at the time, very, very famous, still quite famous to a lot of people of a certain age in Australia and England, but at the time, a very famous guy. And so that's how Paul Onions described him in his statement. And Ivan says, well, his mustache changed a lot over the years, and it wasn't actually in the Merv Hughes style at the time.
And there's photos of that to show that he didn't have it. So, I mean, it's a very tenuous case to try and link this together. And it's actually quite surprising. I was speaking to Merv Hughes one time on Studio 10 about it, because, I mean, when you get me in a room with the Merv Hughes moustache, I had to ask the question. He goes, well, it got me the job on Fat Pizza. I've got to play Ivan Milat on the show.
Did he?
So it was a bit of a surreal moment. I had to ask.
I'm so glad you did. Because I wonder what Merv Hughes makes of this. I'm so glad you got to ask him.
Yeah, he's like, it was huge, he says, but it got me a job.
How bizarre. Wow. So now to your other point about there being no physical evidence to link Ivan to the crimes, of course, police say that they did find evidence in the form of gun shells and that they can link the weapons used to weapons owned by Ivan?
Well, the thing is that they say that they can link gun parts to Ivan and to the case, except the vital part that would do the striations on the casings was never found.
Right.
So basically they say it was a 22 Ruger and we found 22 Ruger parts in his house. The fact that... it's one of the most popular rifles in the country and probably the world. I mean, that's like saying he used a fork. It was very much just a wide-reaching statement, and they just assumed that the parts that were in his house were what were used in these cases. However, Ivan actually goes even further into this and said that they swept his house for days and days and days and days and days. And then after they'd finished, a young cop walks into his house and goes, oh, hang on a sec, there's a casing there on his bedroom floor, and photographs it and picks it up, that it had been missed in all these sweeps. And what do you know, that one casing matched one of the cases of one of the victims being killed.
Right.
So, you know,
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Okay, again.
Yeah, this wasn't found in various sweeps. It was found afterwards.
Okay. Also, the car that Ivan owned at the time was said to be the car that was identified by Paul Onions, was it?
Yes.
Yes.
And the woman who picked him up.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And he was able to identify the car because it had a great big wheel cover thing on the back because it's a big four-wheel drive. Yep. Again, there was evidence to show that Ivan didn't have a car like that at the time.
I mean, so it seemed to be Paul Onions, but also it seemed from reading the book by Clive Small, who was the lead investigator on the case, that it was Ivan's brother who gave the most damning clues in the lead up to Ivan's arrest. Is that how it seemed to you? Ivan's brother Alex.
Well, I don't know. There's several brothers that sort of seem to have given stories. Now, a bit of an exclusive here for you.
Thank you.
Alex actually had gone to the police multiple times and claimed to have seen the two British backpackers after they were officially last seen. So he claims that he saw them in a different car, that they were concerned and he was worried about them. So it makes you wonder what was going on there, that maybe him talking about this sort of stuff made them look at the family, maybe?
Yeah, what
it's is... Very, you know, lots of question marks here. But, yes, I have it from a really good source that actually Alex went to the police multiple times with his fanciful stories that they sort of dismissed, but at the same time it sort of raised a few alarm bells.
Well, and it was Alex who actually handed in the first piece of physical evidence, which was the famous T-shirt. Was it the T-shirt or the photograph of the T-shirt that was identified as belonging to one of the backpackers?
Yeah, I think it was the photo with Ivan's girlfriend wearing it. So it was the green and white striped one.
And Alex gave that to police. So he actually sort of, well, not sort of, he definitely gave police the first solid link between the backpackers and Ivan.
Mm-hmm.
It's
a T-shirt by a very famous brand.
Yeah.
I don't believe in coincidences, but sometimes they can happen. But it just sort of shows how sort of weak all of these links are, that they arrested someone because they saw a photo of someone in a similar T-shirt that they didn't even know if the backpacker had with them at the time. You know, you often dump stuff when you have to go on longer trips along the highways and things like that. You know,
But it's a bit of a stretch to think that then Alex was able to go and that Alex had an inventory of the T-shirts that the backpackers had, and then he was able to go and find a photograph of Ivan's girlfriend wearing a similar T-shirt.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
but also
I agree with you there.
But what is Alex's story? Like, what do you make of it? Does Ivan talk about his brothers and Alex in particular? Does he feel as though Alex put him in?
No, he talks about Bill more than anyone, because he's the one who turns up on TV all the time. He has horrible names for him. So he's the only one in the family who isn't standing solid with Ivan. So he's the one who says, and I think Ivan did this case, and I think Ivan was there, and I think Ivan murdered this person and that person. And so he hates him with a passion. He's actually changed his name now, but he keeps turning up on TV anyway.
Does he really?
Mm-hmm. I think the most recent one, he claimed that Ivan shot, I think, a taxi driver or something. So it gets Ivan riled up. He really starts going on when all of this goes down.
Here is some audio from that recent TV appearance by Ivan's brother Bill, who now calls himself Boris Malat. It's on the Sunday night program on Channel 7.
When Ivan was just 17, the skinny teenager pointed a gun at a taxi driver's head.
And he said, yeah, he said, I just stuck a gun in a bloke's thing. And he took the money there, he robbed the money there, he got the money there. And that was it. Soon as the gun got in the hands of that fool, life changed.
Milat was 17, armed and dangerous. He'd already robbed one taxi driver and was planning to rob another.
It's Boris Malat on Channel 7 there. And is it just me, or were you expecting him to have changed the Malat part of his name? Anyway, after the break, we'll hear more about the family Malat. Coming up on Australian True Crime, I'll put Amanda on the spot and ask who she thinks is the other killer. But first, let's find out why so many people called those police tip-off lines and suggested that they have a look at the Malats in the early 90s. What can you tell us about the Malat family before this case? Because certainly there is an understanding that they were a pretty creepy family, and that a lot of tips came in. That's the story in the book. The story is that a lot of people rang up and said, have you looked at the Malats? They're a pretty creepy family.
Well, I mean, they're a very large family, and they were still pretty close. I mean, that they're, you know, half Serbian, and they would have big parties, and there would be alcohol, though Ivan doesn't drink himself, you know, and they would get out the big guns literally and take photos, and we've seen all those photos. And they would have a lot of time together. They would go hunting. There was almost a pack mentality with some of the boys. So there was, you know, car thefts earlier. There was, you know, some assaults on girls. There's actually some history that I've been digging through, that there was some assault on some of the boys as well, because they were a bit wild, and they were expected to, if you weren't going to do well at school, that you actually have to be home and working hard for their father, who worked them from you know, daybreak to to dusk, and they would just do this over and over every single day. And so they would get into trouble because they didn't have any sort of excitement. So they would go and create their own because they would be working so hard from such a young age.
And I guess money was tight, so making your own fun. Sure.
Yeah. I mean, mum was often sick, so, you know, and there was lots of babies coming all the time. So it was about everyone pitching in and doing everything that they could. And so, you know, some of the boys ran wild and would get into trouble, and Ivan ended up in Boys Town for a while and all of this sort of stuff.
And one of the earliest ideas that came out in the investigation when they started sort of looking at profiles, potential profiles of perpetrators, was this idea that firstly that there were two people involved in the murders, secondly that it was potentially brothers, and thirdly that it was probably an older brother who was very who was the aggressor, the more sort of the more interesting, yeah, the more dominant over a younger brother. And that sort of seems to fit that story that you're telling as well, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, we're talking about when you look at cases like this, people think, oh, yeah, it's quite easy for one man to abduct two people and kill them in two different ways. Imagine the logistics of all of that. You have to imagine, you know, a gun in this arm, a samurai sword in this arm, two victims who are fighting you, regardless of theories of being tied up and everything, when he has had people escape because he hadn't tied them up until they were on the freeway. You know, there's all of this sort of stuff that sort of creates an area where it would be easier if there was two. You know, if he picked up one hitchhiker like Simone, one-on-one is a lot easier. But then when we get down to the way that he killed, where, you know, one shot and one stabbed, it's really interesting that people actually think that one person would do that because, yes, they might have a knife in their back pocket and their rifle, but it's usually a preference, you know. Killers seem to pick a weapon of choice and kind of stick to it, that they actually do learn and they do create a better MO, but you don't sort of swap and change with all of your victims. And when one's been decapitated with a single blow, I mean, that takes such great strength, and it's really tough to do that while you're shooting someone else and everything. And actually Ivan talks about it, that In trial, they claimed that he was just sort of sitting there and watching the second perpetrator, and he goes, "What? I was having a cup of coffee or something while this was going on." I mean, some of it seems ridiculous for them to say there's no possible way that there's a second killer. It's there has to be.
But certainly there was sort of a ritualistic style to the way the bodies were found, wasn't there? I mean, they seem to have been posed face down.
Yeah, and they were all covered in just enough branches to sort of hide them from the casual observer. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't about hiding them, but it was just about making sure that they weren't found immediately. And let's face it, the Victorian couple were actually there for 5 years.
Mm.
So, but yeah, it was about dumping them and degrading them as best the killer could.
And it appeared as though the killer or killers had spent considerable time there at the scene. They didn't seem to have been in a hurry. There were lots of cigarette butts found, and you know, to Ivan's sort of joke about what was I doing having a cup of coffee. I mean, it seemed as though the killer didn't hurry and took his time to soak it up.
You didn't need to hurry. You're in the middle of nowhere. No one is going to come, and if they do, you're going to see headlights for a quarter of an hour before they get to you. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, we know that Ivan's great-nephew decided to use that area as his own killing ground a decade or so later, I think. Don't ask me timelines. Yeah. And, you know, he did exactly the same thing because it's so secluded and no one is going to find you. No one is going to hear you scream. No one's going to hear gunfire. It's a perfect killing ground, sadly.
But as you say, there is no physical evidence at the scene and no DNA. Even with all those cigarette butts, they weren't able to get DNA or haven't been yet able to get Ivan's DNA from the scene.
Well, Ivan is a non-smoker.
Oh.
Wow. So he actually talks in a couple of conversations we had that his friends at the RTA actually thought he was strange because they'd go out for, you know, hard drinking nights, but when they've been on the trucks all day and they'd all get rip-roaring drunk and everything, and he's a non-drinker and a non-smoker, and they thought he was strange because he's this, you know, hard man who loves his guns but doesn't drink or smoke. So instantly when we have cigarette butts, you got to think, well, whose are they?
Wow. Fascinating. Mm-hmm.
And we have the Tollgate girls who disappeared as well, and the person that was seen with them was a heavy smoker.
Tell us about the Tollgate girls.
So these were two Sydney nurses, Gillian Jamieson and Deborah Balkin. They actually disappeared in 1980 from the Tollgate Hotel, which is in Parramatta. Now, Ivan has been fingered for this case many, many times over the years, though the coroner's now saying, you know, I don't think it's him. He seemed to be a pretty easy target for a lot of these sort of cases.
Yeah.
And the suspect was seen heavily smoking while he was talking to these girls. Again, it was a guy with a moustache and all of that sort of stuff. And Ivan, I remember when they were going to take him for questioning and everything, he goes, oh, they have to ask me, do I smoke? He goes, and it's a stupid thing that would for me to say to them, I've never smoked, so basically it can't be me.
Mm.
So it's really crazy. So, you know, when everyone says, oh, there's cigarette butts in Belanglo Forest, Ivan's a non-smoker. So instantly we have a second person at the scene.
I think Ivan was even mentioned in connection with the Lynette Dawson case, wasn't he, at some point?
Oh, he's been connected with so many cases. There's Peter Felcher, I think, who was found at Jenolan Caves. I think that's almost a definite.
Okay. I'm just reading about the Peter Letcher case now that you mention it. Friday, November 1987, Mr. Letcher found himself flat broke and in need of a lift to Bathurst from Sydney. Last seen alive, November 13. Oh, yes, I remember his photo. Hitchhiking and never made it. Around about the same time, Malat was working for the Department of Main Roads in the area. And in 1988, two bushwalkers came across his remains off a forest trail in the Jenolan Caves.
Yeah. So the Jenolan Caves area was an area that the Malat family went to a lot.
His body was found lying face down in a shallow ditch covered in branches and leaf litter. So, yeah, you're right, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
In keeping with the style that we saw in Belanglo.
And there's a few others. There was a woman, I was doing some research on a very different case the other day, and I came across a woman who'd been dumped covered in branches in another forest. But police don't believe that it's linked, so I don't know why, so I have to do a bit more digging on that case.
Okay.
But it sounded far more similar than these people who have just vanished off the face of the earth.
And, of course, there was the earlier abduction, well, alleged abduction and sexual assault of the two women who accused Ivan, and then when the case came to court, it got very strange, didn't it? One of the women then said that she sort of withdrew her accusations in the courtroom, didn't she? This was years before the murders, and said that it sort of all happened because she was gay and didn't understand her own sexuality and was confused. And what happened there?
Yeah, she sort of said that that she had complied because she thought it would be easier and that maybe it wasn't actually a forceful assault. And a lot of these things happen, and when we look at it with hindsight, we can say, well, had something else had happened then, if they had decided to pursue the case more than they did, you know, it might have changed the trajectory of the whole history of Australian criminal history. But she sort of reneged on her story, and then Ivan fled to New Zealand.
I mean, the trouble, though, is that even had he been convicted of those sexual assaults, he wouldn't have gone to jail for long, as we know, in Australia.
Oh, so no.
It probably wouldn't have changed the history of Australian crime. But yeah, it's a very strange case. And in retrospect, they sort of talk about he had a fantastic lawyer. And even that man himself, his lawyer sort of says, well, it wasn't my greatest moment looking back.
Yeah, there's a lot of strange spots in this case. It's one of the weirdest stories that we have in this country, and we've been fed a single line of what we have to believe. And if we start to dig it a little further beyond the surface story, there's so much more that doesn't make sense, that we're just told, yeah, don't worry about that. That doesn't link up. I mean, even in court, there was evidence to prove that Ivan Milat wasn't at two of the killings. I think it was the two Germans. Mm. And in the case, they said, oh, well, just because you weren't there for one doesn't mean that you didn't do the others. It's like, to me, I thought this was a similar fact case, that we have seven victims and one killer.
Yeah.
But to say, well, you did five, so we'll just add on the other two, it's just beyond ridiculous. It was the anniversary of his father's death, and wow, him and his mother had spent a couple of days together out at the cemetery. Mm. And there's proof of that. And this was when some of the victims had disappeared. I'm pretty sure it was the German couple. Mm. And, yeah, so he wasn't there. And they just go, yeah, but it's okay, we're adding it in anyway.
And what can you tell us about the hair that was found in the hand of Joanne Walters? One of the victims was clutching a handful of hair when they found her body.
This is where it gets totally bizarre, and for people to believe the story that we've just been told, it just makes absolutely no sense. So they come out just a few weeks ago and said that DNA evidence has finally pointed to the hair being Joanne's own hair.
Mm.
Now, they were able to say it wasn't Ivan's hair in 94.
Mm-hmm.
So don't you think they would have tested it against her hair too in 94?
Right. Well, they're saying now that at the time they looked at it and thought it was a man's hair. So
you can't say, oh, well, we're not going to test it against the victims.
Mm.
Yeah. You know, it's like taking fingerprint evidence and saying, well, we're not going to check to see if these were the victim's fingerprints. Well, we'll just assume it's not because they're large. I mean, it's absolutely crazy. So for them to come in now and say, oh, no, it's okay, it's not a second killer's hair, it's Joanne, so we can stop talking about it now, you know,
it is very,
that does not make sense to me.
It is odd. So yeah, with all this talk of there being at least another killer, I mean, who is it? Who was it? Who do you think?
Oh, Michelle, do we go there?
Yeah, we have to go there.
Because he lives locally. So.
Oh, right, okay. I've even heard one of Ivan's sister's names bandied about.
So John Marsden, who was a lawyer for the Milat family for many, many years, and he's actually he was a local identity around Campbelltown. He's passed away, but on his deathbed, he claimed that Shirley, Ivan's sister, who lived with him in the house here at Eaglevale, was one of the killers as well. Now, it was very left field, but I mean, there's evidence to suggest that she wasn't very feminine. I mean, I don't think I am either, but she was quite a tough lady, but it's still, I think, for a case like this where we have victims being decapitated, it does take the strength of a man to do that. And I've seen video footage of other brothers and the family, like Richard. He was actually asked on an outtake on Australian Story, who's the better shooter in the family? And there's a micro expression that he shows that he wants to boast, but he shuts himself down. It's actually quite telling that he won't want to say, I'm a great shooter, and it sort of makes you then think, well, is he the shooter and Ivan the stabber?
Mm.
You know, it just there's just a micro expression. I probably watched it probably 200 times. Just watch this hint of glee that he goes to say something and then backs off. I don't know. I found it chilling.
Also, though, there is that idea that serial killers never stop killing until they're stopped. So do you think someone can stop because their brother was arrested for the crime and they got away with it, so they'll stop? Does that make sense?
They say killers will never stop, but I mean, we can look at the Golden State Killer. You get to a point that you're too old.
That's true. Yeah,
you can't keep going. You would love to keep going, but you know, especially those that are sexual serial killers, parts of them don't work.
Yeah, right.
You know, and they need drugs to do it, and you know, it's just too much of a hassle. It gets to a point, it can almost be like a full-time job, horrifically, for some of these, that you get to a point that, you know, climbing into windows or trying to fight a young victim, they're going to overpower you and you're going to get caught. So you have to live on your fantasies. But we do actually catch the killers before they get to that point. I mean, we can look at like John Wayne Glover, who was in his 50s when he was killing, but that's why he chose elderly women at lunchtime.
Yeah, absolutely. The granny killer from Sydney, right? Yeah.
Yeah. So
that makes sense. Yeah.
Sorry, I don't talk about these names. I forget that not everyone knows them all. It's just my brain. I'm sorry.
That's all right.
But yeah, you get to a point that, you know, the backpacker case, these are teenagers and young 20-year-olds, that if you're in your 40s like Ivan was, there's only so long that you will have the strength to fight them. So if there's a second killer out there and likely around the same age brother, well, then they're in their 60s and 70s now. You wouldn't still be attacking. But there can also be issues with some mental health issues that sort of makes you decline. A drug use and things like that, sometimes that the stress of being close to being caught can actually shut them down.
So you're still writing to Ivan?
Yes, I am. Yes, I actually have a letter in my handbag now I need to respond to.
Okay, so what's the latest? I mean, we know that over the years he's been self-harming in jail and still professes his innocence and So what's the latest?
I believe if he did a lie detector test, he would pass. He's completely and utterly convinced whether he's guilty or not. He would pass it because he knows in his heart that he didn't do it. But does that make sense?
Yeah, no, it absolutely does, because that's what you need to pass a lie detector, is you need to believe it.
Mm-hmm. It's so weird that we know of his history of self-harming, and yet his letters have staples in them.
That is weird.
So I don't know who staples them, because he writes the envelopes himself. So I don't know if he leaves them open and they staple them for him, but it seems odd that they would do that. I've never asked, actually.
Yeah.
But they used to be stuck together, but now they're stapled. So it's quite odd. But he is threatening more self-harm because he's waiting for another appeal that is slow on the uptake.
Mm.
So he's getting a bit frustrated, and we were actually talking about, you know, he goes, I've got 9 fingers, so I've got plenty more to fight with.
Is he in his 60s now or 70s even?
70. So I think he's 71, 72. Wow. So he's quite old. He doesn't think he'll get out, but he's going to keep fighting anyway.
Wow. And you're going to keep writing?
Yeah, I write to about 150 killers currently, so there's a lot coming and going. So there's some exciting cases that are happening and some appeals that I'm aware of, and some crazy stuff like Cookie Monster pictures I get sent often, which really freaks me out. But
who's sending you Cookie Monster pictures? What's that about?
Haddon Clark, he's a serial killer in the US. He had 2 victims, and one was a young child, which makes it even more creepy.
Oh, my God.
I used to love Cookie Monster. Mm. He was my favourite Sesame Street character.
Me too.
Yeah, but not anymore.
Thank you so much for downloading this episode of Australian True Crime. I'm so sorry I didn't get around to thanking our Patreon patrons in this episode. I'm very nervous, is the truth. I'm heading off on a crazy trip for a show, an SBS show called Go Back to Where You Came From, and I'm absolutely packing it. And I'm leaving tomorrow. I don't know how to explain it. You know, it's obviously before you're listening to this, but I'm editing this the night before I go, and I'm heading off to a place. I don't think I can tell you where the place is right now, or can I? I don't know.
but I'm very afraid and I'm leaving my family and I don't want to. And there's part of me that's tempted to actually pack up my family right now and flee to a caravan park at the beach and just hide out so they can't make me go. Oh, God, rambling, drinking wine while I'm editing, trying to avoid thinking about it. So that is why I haven't gotten around to doing a proper Patreon shout out. But I can tell you that it's patreon.com/AustTrueCrimePod, A-U-S-T, True Crime Pod is how you can become a supporter of our True Crime podcast. And I know that I've put extra stuff on there because I did that earlier to make sure that I had done it before I started drinking wine and editing this because I'm so afraid of the trip that I'm taking. But you can see it on SBS. I think it's on the 2nd, 3rd and 4th of October, and you can definitely see it on SBS, I don't know, whatever their live service is that you can see online. Should have done this before I started drinking. But thank you to everybody for everything. And yeah, just good luck to everyone. I had to do this training session yesterday with our security guy where he had to tell me what to do if I was kidnapped. And that has sort of freaked me out, to be honest. And he's a great person and I really enjoyed his company, but that has really freaked me out. So, yeah, today I'm struggling because tonight the night that I'm editing the Malat podcast to put it online is the night before I fly out to the place I probably can't mention because I've probably signed a contract to say that I wouldn't tell you before a certain date. I'm so lost. I can't remember. But anyway, thank you. Good luck to everyone, mostly me, because I'm going to a war zone. But this podcast is my joy, my pride and joy. So thank you to you for listening. Thank you to Emily for doing it with me. Thank you to our patrons for supporting us. And see you soon. Hopefully, fingers crossed, guys. Please watch this show on SBS. I can't remember what I can tell you about it. Anyway, bye.